This morning our text is Genesis 44. Genesis 44, we're still making our way through the book of beginnings. And we find ourselves in the middle of the Joseph narrative. And we learn that Joseph is testing his brothers. Due to a severe famine throughout the land, the brothers show up unexpectedly for food, and they are unaware of Joseph's identity and his position. And Joseph needs to know a few things. Are these the same brothers with the same evil intent 20 years before who sold him as a slave? He needs to know. Can he trust them? He needs to know, are they sorry for what they did? He needs to know if there's been any change in these brothers over the last two decades. He wants to know if Benjamin, the youngest, is still alive. And he wants to know if Jacob trusts the brothers, the sons. Now in chapter 43, answers to the test begin to emerge. Last week we noted several of these answers that begin to emerge from Joseph's test. We see that there's the brother's pledge. Judah steps up and says, I'll pledge my safety for Benjamin. We see a father's trust. Jacob does trust the boys to bring Benjamin to Egypt. We do see that Benjamin is alive. And we see that in their great meal of mercy, when Benjamin gets the five portion spread before him, that the jealousy has been tempered among the brothers. So some of the answers begin to surface. But in chapter 43, we see that the door is cracked open a bit. We begin to see that God is doing something in the family, particularly with Judah. So the breadcrumbs of chapter 43, his pledge of safety, his sacrificial responsibility, his convincing dad of the whole trip, and him emerging as the leader of the family, all of that points us to Judah's significant shining moment in our chapter today. So the door's cracked open, 43. And in chapter 44 today, the door swings wide open and we see what God has been doing and is doing in the life of not only Joseph, but Judah. So in today's chapter, today's text, chapter 44, the door is open and all comes to light with what we can call Joseph's final test for his brothers. The question is, will they pass or will they fail? Our first heading will be a test of loyalty. Final test, a test of loyalty. Look with me in verses 1 through 17. Then he, meaning Joseph, this is after the meal of mercy, next morning. Then he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sack with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. And put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, Benjamin, with his money for the grain. And the steward did as Joseph told him. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this. But when when he overtook them, the steward spoke to them these words. And they, the brothers, said to him, "Why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money that we found in the mouths of our sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die. And we also will be my Lord's servants." He, the steward, said, "Let it be as you say. He who is found with it, the silver cup, shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent." Then each man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack, and he searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he, Joseph, was still there. They fell before him to the ground. Joseph said to him, "What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?" And Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also in whose hand the cup has been found." But Joseph said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." We have a test of loyalty from Joseph. We can call this the silver cup scheme, because this is a set up. Clearly, undeniably, Joseph is setting them up for a test of loyalty. Clearly and unmistakably, the setup is from Joseph. So how will they react to all this is the question. The steward tracks them down, accuses them for repaying evil for good. He says, "Why have you done such evil when my master has done such good to you?" It's not only a charge of theft, taking the silver cup, but it's also a charge of ingratitude. Like, he treated you so well, and now you're going to do this. Well, what is this whole thing of divination? A couple times mentioned in the text. There was a Near Eastern form of divination where you would take objects or liquids and place them into a vessel of water. Whatever the object might be, whatever the colored liquid may be, you would put it in the vessel of water. And whatever patterns and forms and shapes began to emerge and take place in the cup, they saw that as a way to determine future events. So if, like, it made a picture of a horse, you know how clouds make pictures of stuff in the sky? If it makes a picture of a horse, they would determine something in the future about, man, we need to get a lot of chariots or something. Just how they worked. It was a practice in the Near Eastern Egyptian culture. They believed they could determine the future by whatever patterns formed in the vessels of water, by whatever liquids and objects they were using. A couple things to note here. It's important to note in the text that it is not promoting that practice. Nor does the text say that Joseph unmistakably practiced it himself. Now, why do I say that? It doesn't indicate that Joseph actually practiced the stuff. At the end of the day, it's hard to imagine Joseph practicing such pagan rituals. Remember what's going on. The whole thing is a setup. The whole context suggests this is a setup and a tactic and a test to bring his brothers along for the setup. This too, this whole divination cup, is also part of the setup. Well, why do we say that? Because Joseph has been clear and courageous when it comes to future events. Joseph has testified throughout his life that revelation and interpretation belong to God alone. We've seen that in previous chapters. With Pharaoh's dreams, he tells Pharaoh. With the cupbearer and the baker, he tells them, interpretations belong to God. So this cup, whatever it was considered precious, special, and had some kind of spiritual use attached to it for the scheme. And all this would serve to intensify the fear of the brothers and the punishment that they deserved. You see, it was not just any cup. It was the special silver cup of spiritual significance that they had taken from Joseph. So likely it's just part of the whole ruse to get them good and scared, to test them for their loyalty. Now notice their response in verse 7. We would never do such a thing. They said, look, remember, we brought the money back to you. We're honest guys. We found the money in our sack. We brought it all the way back from Canaan to Egypt. We brought the money back. Why in the world would we steal silver and gold if we brought the money back? And they're so convinced that they're innocent, they say, anyone who's found guilty, put him to death. Well, the steward says, look, we're not going to go that far. But whoever's found guilty will be the servant of my master, Joseph. And the rest of you can go. The steward replies, whichever one is guilty will serve the sentence. And the search begins. He's going through their stuff from the oldest to the youngest. Again, remember, 1 in 39 million chance that you get that right when they were sitting at the table. Goes from eldest to youngest, and they find the silver cup in Benjamin's sack. Can you imagine the moment? The text says they tear their clothes. Why does that matter? To tear the clothes was an outward sign of an inward grief. An outward sign of an inward grief. Because they're thinking, everything's about to change. They were headed back to Canaan. They had food for the famine. They've got Simeon and Benjamin with them going back. And now Benjamin's guilty. And they tear their clothes. And I cannot imagine how depressing the journey back to Joseph must be. They've got their clothes torn and their heads hanging low as they go back. Joseph is there waiting on them. Now, interestingly, who's the one guilty? Benjamin. But they all go back. That's not insignificant. They could have said, yon yon, Benji, we're going back today. You did it, you're guilty, we're out of here. We've got families to feed. They go back. They attend and they go back. That's notable. They're showing some degree of loyalty which they did not show 20 years earlier with Joseph. They left him. Remember? They're not leaving Benjamin. All right. That's important. That's good. And then in verse 14, there's an emphasis. Did you catch it in verse 14 when Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house? Why in the world would you say it like that? Moses, being the writer of the first five books, emphasizes Joseph, Judah, and the brothers. Why? To emphasize he has emerged as the leader of the group. That's why he's mentioned. I mean, why wouldn't you just say they all went back? So it's not just some editorial emphasis by Moses alone. Moses is being carried along by the Spirit to record the God-breathed word. And God wanted the emphasis of Judah with the brothers to be emphasized. And you see it in 14, Judah and his brothers. You see it in 16, Judah speaks. You see it in 18, Judah speaks. He's the leader and representative of the group. And that's becoming clear as the narrative unfolds. And they make it back to Joseph and they fall before him. Which automatically takes us back again to chapter 37, verse 7, when Joseph had the dreams that he would be exalted and his brothers would be bowed down. But it's also to show that they are casting themselves on the mercy of Joseph. This is a guilty group, as far as they can see. And they're casting themselves on the mercy of Joseph. Joseph says in 15, like, what have you done? What are you doing? Don't you know that I know things? This is my cup. I know things. Maybe even another tactic of like, you need to start fessing up, guys. And then Judah humbly acknowledges, God has found out our guilt. Now in the scene, only Benjamin is guilty. Only he had the silver cup. Yet Judah says, we are guilty before God. Again, we saw in chapter 42, this heaviness of guilt still weighs on the brothers. They're still fearful of divine justice. They know what they did to Joseph, and it's haunting them. It comes up over and over again. This isn't just Benjamin being guilty. It's the whole group. It's a collective confession of sin in the Joseph event. God has found us out. Joseph speaks in verse 16 on behalf of the group as their representative. All the brothers do not speak. Only Judah does. And he says, oh, what shall we say? What shall we do? I mean, our hand was caught in the cookie jar. We're guilty. They acknowledge a just punishment for the wages of their sin. They cast themselves on the mercy of Joseph, and they also submit to the justice of God. Judah offers all of them to be servants by the stolen silver cup. We're all here. We'll be your servants. And then Joseph, still setting them up, says, oh, you don't all have to stay. This one was guilty. He stays as my servant. You all can go back in peace to your father. Now, here is the moment. What do you do? Joseph's laid it out on the table. You are free to go, guys. Go back to Dad. Bring the money and the food. You've got everything that you need. Go in peace to your father. So what do you do with the offer on the table? What do? This is the defining moment of the final test. Joseph offers them the chance to leave Benjamin as a slave and return freely and peacefully to Jacob. Remember, this is exactly what they did to Joseph 20 years earlier. So now the other offer's on the table. And then we see Judah's speech and Judah's substitution. Judah's speech and his substitution. His speech is long. There's a lot of Lord servant language that can kind of trip us up. Because he goes back and forth between him and his dad being servants to the Lord. But just stay with me. Verse 18, Judah's speech and substitution. And the men were afraid. That's 43. Verse 18, 44. Then Judah went up. So Judah's been the one speaking. Then Judah went up to him, Joseph, and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ear. Let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My Lord, you, Joseph, asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we told you, 'We have a father and an old man and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him.' We said to my Lord, 'The boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' Then you said to your servants, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again.' When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of you, my Lord. And when our father said, 'Go again, buy us a little food,' we said, 'We can't go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our younger brother is with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons.'" Now that's a dig, right? I mean, what are all the other sons? Chop liver? One left me. And I said, "Surely he's been torn to pieces, Joseph. And I've never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm happens to him, you'll bring down my gray hairs in evil to Sheol, the grave. Now therefore, as soon as I came to your servant, my father, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave, Sheol. For your servant, me, Judah, your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life.'" And put your finger on verse 33. "Now therefore, please let me, your servant, Judah, remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me?
I fear to see the evil that would bind my father. Now, this is quite a speech. Notice the posture of the speech. He asks, can I please speak into your ears? Don't be angry. He approaches. Lord servant language is used in the whole speech. He and the brothers and his dad, they are servants to Joseph, Lord, who's like Pharaoh. Now Judah's speech contains three parts. He's got his pledge to his father that he tells Joseph about, his plea to Joseph, and then his substitution for Benjamin. First, the pledge that he makes to his father. He explains how the events unfold. He says, look, my father and the youngest son, they share a peculiar bond. My father's life is bound up to the boy. He loves him, and he can't live without him. If we go back, Dad will go to the grave. And then he's got his plea, second, to Joseph. Pledge to his father, his plea to Joseph. Here, Judah humbly rises as the leader and representative of the band of brothers. Why does that matter? He's not the oldest. He's the fourth born son. He's a middle child. Yet, he's the one who stands up for the group. He's the one who speaks up for the group. And in his speech, he's making a sincere, sacrificial plea for the sake of his brother, Benjamin, for the sake of his father, back in Canaan. And then the third part of the speech is a substitution for Benjamin. Judah's whole speech leads to substitution. And notice that it is a self-giving substitution. We see it in verses 33 and 34. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. Let me stay, and let the boy go. Let him go back, and I'll stay and bear the punishment instead of the boy. There's the substitutionary language. Me for him. Now this is quite the contrast with old Judah, isn't it? He's quite the character, but indeed a change has been wrought in Judah. This shows us more clearly that this is a different Judah than chapter 37 and chapter 38, 20 plus years earlier. This is a different man right here. This is a clear display of Judah for what we call sacrificial responsibility. Sacrificial responsibility. He takes the responsibility to give himself up for his brother and his father. Now, this sacrificial responsibility was willing, substitutionary, and transforming. Willing. He, of his own accord, gives himself. Substitutionary. Me for him. I'll serve, he goes free. I'll be the slave, he goes in peace. Substitutionary. And it's transforming. Because we're going to see in the next chapter, the dam breaks. The dam breaks. And this very family will be reconciled and preserved I'll stay if he can go. This pledge, this plea, this substitute, it comes at a high cost for Judah. In this moment, he's willing to give up everything for Benjamin. Remember, he has family back home. He's giving up everything in that moment for Benjamin. He gives up his family and his freedom in that moment to take Benjamin's place. So what we see here, with the door wide open now, is Judah's sacrificial responsibility for his brother and his father. And I remind you today, as I explained last week, and applied last week, sacrificial responsibility. Giving up yourself willingly and honorably for others. Sacrificial responsibility is a hallmark and virtue of biblical manhood. It's a virtue of biblical manhood, and it's also definitional of biblical manhood, and it reflects Christ's own glory, who loved the church and gave himself for her. So for one's wife, and for one's children, for one's family, for one's community, for one's country, men in general, and Christians in particular, are called to sacrificial responsibility. So are you displaying sacrificial responsibility, my brother in the Lord? Are you willing to gladly assume that role as a man? Because it does mean something to be a man, and we do have a calling from the Lord, and it's our role to give ourselves up. Because Christ gave himself up for his bride and for his body, the church. Now we can see, surely you can see, a parallel, a precious parallel to Christ in the text. Some of you know exactly where I'm going, right? There's certainly a parallel. As good as it was for Judah to pledge himself for his family, greater is the pledge of Jesus for the family of God. And like Judah, the sacrificial responsibility of Jesus is willing, substitutionary, and transforming. As Judah spoke on behalf of his brothers, Jesus speaks on behalf of his brothers and intercedes continually for them. As Judah stood in the place of Benjamin, Jesus stands in the place of his bride, always interceding. As Judah offered his service for Benjamin's freedom, so Jesus offered his service for our freedom. And as Judah displayed sacrificial responsibility for his father's sake, so Jesus displayed sacrificial responsibility for his father's sake. The parallel is undeniable. The breadcrumbs in this powerful scene in Egypt lead us all the way to the life of Christ. John 15:13. No greater love has one than this, that a man lay down his life Mark 10:45.
For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. For many. Jesus is the perfect pledge of his people. Hebrews 7:22. Jesus himself takes the responsibility to fulfill the debt we owe. That's what he does. I want to land the plane this morning with one hymn, one verse, and one quote. Hear the language of self-giving substitution. One hymn. His robes for mine. Oh, wonderful exchange. Clothed in my sin, Christ suffered beneath God's rage. Draped in his righteousness, I'm justified. In Christ I live, for in my place he died. His robes for mine. What cause have I for dread? God's daunting law Christ mastered in my stead. Faultless I stand with righteous works not mine, saved by my Lord's vicarious death and life. His robes for mine. God's justice is appeased. Jesus is crushed and thus the Father pleased. Christ drank God's wrath on sin, then cried, 'Tis done. Sin's wage is paid, propitiation won. And his robes for mine, such anguish none can know. Christ, God's beloved, condemned as though his foe. He, as though I, accursed, and left alone, I, as though he, embraced and welcomed home. That's what it means. That's what it means when we think about substitution. He, for me. One verse. 2 Corinthians 5:21. For our sake, he, God, made him to be sin, who knew no sin. You catch that? For my sake, for our sake, he made him who knew no sin to be sin. So that in him I might become the righteousness of God. Exchange. For our sake, even though he knew no sin, he was treated as sin, so that we might be treated as the righteousness of God in him. Accepted. And one quote from the Old English Baptist, Prince of Preachers, Spurgeon. You stand before God, believer, for the believer. You stand before God as if you were Christ, because Christ stood before God as if he were you. You stand before God as Christ, believer, because Christ stood before God as though he were you. Substitution. I don't
know if there's a better doctrine in the Bible. And I know it's dangerous to make statements like that. So don't hear what I'm not saying. But this is good news, brothers and sisters. It's good news. So have you trusted in the substitutionary work of Jesus? Have you looked to the perfect pledge who stood on your behalf and paid the debt? Have you received with the empty hand of faith all that Jesus won for you and obligated himself to fulfill in your place? Do you know and rejoice in the sufficient substitute, the perfect pledge, the descendant of Judah, Jesus Christ? Oh, the benefits, if you have. And the destruction if you have not. The breadcrumbs of Judah, giving himself for Benjamin, lead us all the way to Calvary. And we can rest and rejoice in our perfect substitute. We thank you, Lord, for the work you have accomplished on our behalf. We not only thank you for an amazing story, we thank you for the reality of what took place then and how it points us. So deal with that.